Hey, hockey fans. Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at usahockeyntdp.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.
Chapter 19 of Sir Charles Danvers by Mary Cholmondeley. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Simon Evers. Chapter 19. In the long evening that followed Ruth's departure from Stoke Moreton, Charles was alone for once in his own home. He was leaving again early on the morrow, but for the time he was alone and heavy at heart. He sat for hours without stirring, looking into the fire. He had no power or will to control his thoughts. They wandered hither and thither and up and down, never for a moment easing the dull, miserable pain that lay beneath them all. Fool, fool that he had been. To have found her after all these years, and to have lost her without a stroke. To have let another take her, and such a man as Dare. To have such a fool's manner that he was thought to be in earnest when he was least so. That now, when his whole future hung in the balance, retribution had overtaken him, and with bitter irony had mocked at his earnestness and made it of none effect. She had thought it was his natural manner to all. His cursed folly had lost her to him. If she had known, surely it would have been, it might have been different. At heart, Charles was a very humble man, though it was not to be expected many would think so. But nevertheless he had a deep, ever-deepening consciousness, common to the experience of the humblest once in a lifetime, that between him and Ruth that mysterious link of mutual understanding and sympathy existed, which cannot be accounted for, which eludes analysis, which yet makes, when the sex happens to be identical, the indissoluble friendship of a David and a Jonathan, a Carlos and a Posa, and where there is a difference of sex, brings about that rarest wonder of the world, a happy marriage. Like cleaves to like. He knew she would have loved him. She was his by right. The same law of attraction which had lifted them at once out of the dreary flats of ordinary acquaintanceship would have drawn them ever closer and closer together till they were knit in one. He knew, with a certainty that nothing could shake, that he could have made her love him, even as he loved her. Unconsciously at first, slowly perhaps, for the current of strong natures like that of deep rivers is sometimes slow. Still, the end would have been the same. And he had lost her by his own act, by his own heedless folly, her want of vanity having lent a hand the while to put her beyond his reach for ever. It was a bitter hour. And as he sat there late into the night beside the fire, that died down to dust and ashes before his absent eyes, ghosts of other heavy hours, ghosts of the past, which he had long since buried out of his sight, came back and would not be denied. To live much in the past is a want of faith in the power that gives the present. Comparatively few men walk through their lives looking backward. Women more frequently do so from a false estimate of life fostered by romantic feeling in youth, which leads them, if the life of the affections is ended, resolutely to refuse to regard existence in any other maturer aspect, and to persist in wandering aimlessly forward, with eyes turned ever on the dim, flowery paths of former days. Let the dead past bury its dead. But there comes a time when the grass has grown over those graves, when we may do well to go and look at them once more, to stand once again in that solitary burial ground, where, as an earnest man had said, are buried broken vows, worn-out hopes, joys, blind and deaf, faiths betrayed or gone astray, lost love, silent spaces where only one mourner ever comes. And in the last retrospective of us, our dead past yet speaks at times, and speaks as one having authority. Such a time had come for Charles now. From the open grave of his love for Ruth, he turned to look at others by which he had stood long ago, in grief as sharp, but which yet in all its bitterness had never struck as deep as this. Memory pointed back to a time 20 years ago, when he had hurried home through a long summer night to arrive at Stoke Moreton too late, to find only the solemn shadow of the mother whom he had loved, and whom he had grieved, too late to ask for forgiveness, too late for anything but a wild passion of grief and remorse and frantic self-accusation. The scene shifted to 10 years later. It was a sultry July evening of the day on which the woman whom he had loved for years had married his brother. He was standing on the deck of the steamer which was taking him from England, looking back at the grey town dwindling against the tawny curtain of the sunset. In his brain was a wild clamour of wedding bells, and across the water, marking the pulse of the sea, came to his outward ears the slow tolling of a bell on a sunken rock near the harbour mouth. It seemed to be tolling for the death of all that remained of good in him. In losing Evelyn, whom he had loved with all the idealism and reverence of a reckless man for a good woman, he believed, in the bitterness of his spirit, that he had lost all, that he had been cut adrift from the last mooring to a better future, that nothing could hold him back now. And for a time it had been so, and he had drowned his trouble in a sea, in which he well nigh drowned himself as well. Once more memory pointed across 5 dark years, to an evening when he had sat as he was sitting now, alone by the wide stone hearth in the hall at Stoke Morton, after his father's death and after the reading of the will. He was the possessor of the old home, which he had always passionately loved, from which he had been virtually banished so long. His father, who had never liked him, but who of late years had hated him as men only hate their eldest sons, had left all in his power to his second son, had entailed every acre of the Stoke Morton and other family properties upon him and his children. Charles could touch nothing, and over him hung a millstone of debt from which there was now no escape. He sat with his head in his hands, the man whom his friends were envying on his accession to supposed wealth and position, ruined. A few days later he was summoned to London by a friend whom he had known for many years. He remembered well that last meeting with the stern old man, whom he had found sitting in his armchair with death in his face. He had once or twice remonstrated with Charles in earlier days, and as he came into his presence now for the last time and met his severe glance, he supposed, with the callousness that comes from suffering which has reached its lowest depths, that he was about to be rebuked again.
"And so," said General Marston sternly, "you have come into your kingdom, into what you deserve."
"Yes," said Charles, "if it is any pleasure to you to know that what you prophesied on several occasions has come true, you can enjoy it. I am ruined."
"You fool," said the sick man slowly, "to have come to 35 and have used up everything which makes life worth having. I am not speaking only of money. There is a bankruptcy in your face that money will never pay. And you had talent and a good heart and the making of a man in you once. I saw that when your father turned you adrift. I saw that when you were at your worst after your brother's marriage. Yes, you need not start. I knew your secret, and kept it as well as you did yourself. I tried to stop you, but you went your own way."
Charles was silent. It was true, and he knew it.
"And so you thought, I suppose, that if your father had made a just will, you could have retrieved yourself?"
"I know I could," said Charles firmly. "But he left the Shire property to Ralph, and every shilling of his capital, and Ralph had my mother's fortune already. I have Stoke Morton and the place in Surrey, which he could not have taken from me, but everything is entailed, down to the trees in the park. I have nominally a large income, but I am in the hands of the Jews. I can't settle with them as I expected, and they will squeeze me to the uttermost. However, as you say, I have the consolation of knowing I brought it on myself."
"And if your father acted justly, as you would call it, which I knew he never would, he would have run through everything in 5 years' time."
"No, I should not. I know I have been a fool, but there are 2 kinds of fools, the kind that sticks to folly all its life, and the kind that has its fling and has done with it. I belong to the second kind. My father had no right to take my last chance from me. If he had left it me, I should have used it."
"You look tired of your fling," said the older man. "Very tired. And you think money would set you right, do you?"
He looked critically at the worn, desperate face opposite him.
"I made my will the other day," he went on, his eyes still fixed on Charles. "I had not much to leave, and I have no near relations, so I divided it among various charitable institutions. I see no reason to alter my will. If one leaves money, however small the sum may be, "'One likes to think it has been left to some purpose, "'with some prospect of doing good. "'A few days ago I had a surprise. "'I fancy it was to be my last surprise in this world. "'I inherited from a distant relation who died intestate "'a large fortune. "'After being a poor man all my days, "'wealth comes to me when I am on the point of going "'where money won't follow. "'Curious, isn't it?' I'm going to leave this second sum in the same spirit as the first, but in rather a different manner. I like to know what I am doing, so I sent for you. I am of opinion that the best thing I can do with it is to set you on your legs again. What do you owe?
Charles turned very red, and then very white.
What do you owe? Repeated the sick man testily. I'm getting tired. How much is it?
He got out a cheque-book and began filling it in.
"'Have you no tongue?' he said angrily, looking up. "'Tell me the exact figure. Well, keep nothing back.'
"'I won't be given the whole,' said Charles with an oath. "'Give me enough to settle the dues, and I will do the rest out of my income. I won't get off scot-free.'
"'Well, then, have your own way, as usual, and name the sum you want. There, take it,' he said feebly, when Charles had mentioned with shame a certain hideous figure. And go. I shall never know what you do with it, so you can play ducks and drakes with it if you like. But you won't like. You have burnt your fingers too severely to play with fire again. You've turned over so many new leaves, that now you've come to the last in the book. I have given you another chance, Charles, but one man can't do much to help another. The only person who can really help you is yourself. Give yourself a chance, too.
How memory brought back every word of that strange interview. Charles saw again the face of the dying man, heard again the stern, feeble voice.
Give yourself a chance.
He had given himself a chance. Some natures, like comets, make strange orbits and return from afar. Charles had returned at last. The old man's investment had been a wise one. But as Charles looked back, after 3 years, he saw that his friend had been right. His money debts had been the least part of what he owed. There were other long-standing accounts which he paid in full during these 3 years, paid in the restless weariness and disappointment that underlay his life, in the loneliness of which he lived, in his contempt for all his former pursuits, which had left him at first devoid of any pursuits at all. He had had, as was natural, very little happiness in his life. But all the bitterness of all his bitter past seemed as nothing to the agony of this moment. He had loved Evelyn with his imagination, but he loved Ruth with his whole heart and soul, and he had lost her. The night was far advanced. The dawn was already making faint bars over the tops of the shutters, was looking in at him as he sat motionless by his dim lamp and his dead fire. And in spite of the growing dawn, it was a dark hour. End of chapter 19.
Chapter 20 of Sir Charles Danvers by Mary Chumley. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Simon Evers. Chapter 20. Dare returned to Vanden in the highest spirits with an enormous emerald engagement ring in an inner waistcoat pocket. He put it on Ruth's third finger a few days later, under the ancient cedar on the terrace at Vanden, a spot which he informed her, for he was not without poetic flights at times, his inner consciousness associated with all the love scenes of his ancestors that were no more. He was stricken to the heart when, after duly admiring it, Ruth gently explained to him that she could not wear his ring at present until her engagement was given out. "Let it then be given out," he said impetuously. "Why already is it not given out?" She explained again, but it was difficult to make him understand, and she felt conscious that if he would have allowed her the temporary use of one hand to release a fly, which was losing all self-control inside her veil, she might have been more lucid. As it was, she at last made him realise the fact that, until Lord Polesworth's return from America in November, no further step was to be taken. "But all is right," he urged with pride. "I've seen my lawyer. I make a settlement. I raise money on the property to make a settlement. There's nothing I will not do. I care for nothing, only to marry you." Ruth led him to talk of other things.
She was very gentle with him, always attentive, always ready to be interested, but anyone less self-centred than Dare would have had a misgiving about her feeling for him. He had none. Half his life he had spent in Paris, and imbued with French ideas of betrothal and marriage, he thought her manner at once exceedingly becoming and natural. She was reserved, but reserve was charming. She did not care for him very much, perhaps, as yet, but as much as she could care for anyone. Most men think that if a woman does not attach herself to them, she is by nature cold. Dare was no exception to the rule, though he would have preferred that there should be less constraint in their present intercourse, that she would be a little more shy and a little less calm. Still, he was supremely happy and proud, and only longed to proclaim the fortunate state of his affairs to the world. One thing about Ruth puzzled him very much, and with a vague misgiving she saw it did so. Her interest in the Vanden cottages, and the schools, and the new pump, had been most natural up to this time. It had served to bring them together. But now the use of these things was past, and yet he observed, with incredulity at first and astonishment afterwards, that she clung to them more than ever. What mattered it for the moment whether the pump was put up or not, or whether the cottages by the river were protected from the floods? Of course in time, for he had promised, a vague something would be done. But why, in the golden season of love and plighted faith, revert to prosaic subjects such as these? Some men are quite unable to believe in any act of a woman being genuine. They always find out that it has something to do with them. If an angel came down from heaven to warn a man of this kind of wrath to come, he would think the real object of her journey was to make his acquaintance. Ruth saw the incredulity in Dare's face when she questioned him, and her heart sank within her. It sank yet lower when she told him one day, with a faint smile, that she knew he was not rich, and that she wanted him to let her help in the rebuilding of certain cottages, the plans of which he had brought over in the summer, which had not yet been begun, apparently for the want of funds. "What you cannot do alone, we can do together," she said. He agreed with effusion. He was surprised, flattered, delighted, but entirely puzzled. The cottages were begun immediately. They were near the river which divided the Slumberley and Vanden properties. Ruth often went to look at them. It did her good to see them rising, strong and firm, though hideous to behold, on higher ground than the poor dilapidated hovels at the water's edge, where fever was always breaking out, which yet made, as they supported each other in their crookedness, and leaned over their own wavering reflections, such a picturesque sketch that it seemed a shame to supplant them by some brand new red brick, such blue tiling, such dreadful little porches. Ruth drew the old condemned cottages, with the long lines of pollarded marshy meadow, and distant bridge and mill in the background, but it was a sketch she never cared to look at afterwards. She was constantly drawing now. There was a vague restlessness in her at this time that made her take refuge in the world of nature, where the mind can withdraw itself from itself for a time into a stronghold where misgiving and anxiety cannot corrupt, nor self break through and steal. In these days she shut out self steadfastly, and fixed her eyes firmly on the future, as she herself had made it with her own hands. She had grown very grave of late. Dare's high spirits had the effect of depressing her more than she would allow, even to herself. She liked him. She told herself so every day, and it was a pleasure to her to see him so happy. But when she had accepted him, he was so diffident, so quiet, so anxious, that she had not realized that he would return to his previous happy self-confidence, his volubility, his grey hats, in fact his former gay self. Directly his mind was at ease, and he had got what he wanted. She saw at once that the change was natural, but she found it difficult to keep pace with, and the effort to do so was a constant strain. She had yet to learn that it is hard to live for those who live for self. Between a nature which struggles, however feebly, towards a higher life, and one whose sole object is gracefully and good-naturedly, but persistently, to enjoy itself, there is a great gulf fixed, of which often neither are aware, until they attempt a close relationship with each other, when the chasm reveals itself with appalling clearness to the higher nature of the two. Ruth was glad when a long-standing engagement to sing at a private concert in one place, and sell modern knick-knacks in old English costume at another, took her from Slamberley for a week, She looked forward to the dreary dissipation in store for her with positive gladness. When the week had passed, and she was returning once more, she wished the stations would not fly so quickly past, that the train would not hurry itself so unnecessarily to bring her back to Slumberley. As the little local line passed Stoke Moreton station, she looked out for a moment, but leaned back hurriedly as she caught a glimpse of the Danvers omnibus in the background, with its great black horses and a footman with a bag standing on the platform. In another moment, Mrs. Alwyn, followed by the footman, made a dart at Ruth's carriage, jumped in, seized the bag, repeated voluble thanks, pressed half her gaily dressed person out again through the window to ascertain that her boxes were put in the van, caught her veil in the ventilator as the train started, and finally precipitated herself into a seat on her bag as the motion destroyed her equilibrium. "Well, Aunt Fanny," said Ruth. "Why, goodness gracious, my dear, if it isn't you! And now I think of it, you were to come home today. Well, how oddly things fall out, to be sure, me getting into your carriage like that. And you'll never guess, Ruth, though for that matter there's nothing so very astonishing about it, as I told Mrs. Thursby, you'll never guess where I've been visiting." Ruth remembered seeing the Danvers omnibus at the station, and suddenly remembered, too, a certain request which she had once made of Charles. "Where can it have been?" she said, with a great show of curiosity. "You will never guess," said Mrs. Alwyn, in high glee. "I should have to tell you. You remember my sprained ankle? There, now I have as good as told you." But Ruth would not spoil her aunt's pleasure, and after numerous guesses, Mrs. Alwyn had the delight of taking her completely by surprise, but at last she leaned forward and said with a rustle of pride, emphasizing each word with a pat on Ruth's knee, "I've been to Stoke Moreton." "How delightful!" ejaculated Ruth. "How astonished I am! Stoke Moreton!" "You may well say that," said Mrs. Alwyn, nodding to her. "Mrs. Thursby would not believe it at first, and afterwards she said she was afraid there would not be any party. But there was, Ruth. There was a married couple, very nice people, of the name of Reynolds. I dare say, being London people, you may have known them. She had quite the London look about her, though not dressed low of an evening, and he was a clergyman who had overworked himself and had come down to Stoke Moreton to rest, and had soup at luncheon. And there was another person besides, a Colonel Middleton, a very clever man, who wrote a book that was printed and had been in India and was altogether most superior. We were three gentlemen and two ladies, but we had ices each night, Ruth, two kinds of ices. And the second night I wore my ruby satin, and the clergyman at Stoke Moreton, that nice young Mr. Brown, who comes to your uncle's chapter meetings, dined with his sister, a very pleasing person indeed, Ruth, in black. In fact, it was a very pleasant little gathering, so nice and informal, and the footman did not wait at luncheon, just put the pudding and the hot plates down to the fire. And Sir Charles so chatty and so full of his jokes. I'd always like to hear him, though my sense of humour is not quite the same as his. Sir Charles has a feeling heart, Ruth. You should have heard Mr. Reynolds talk about him. But he looked very thin and pale, my dear, and he seemed to be always so tired, but still as pleasant as could be. And I told him he wanted a wife to look after him, and I advised him to have an egg beaten up in ever such a little drop of brandy at 11 o'clock. And he said he would think about it. He did indeed, Ruth. So I just went quietly to the housekeeper and asked her to see to it, and a very sensible person she was, Ruth, been in the family 20 years, and thinks all the world of Charles, and showed me the damask tablecloths that were used for the prince's visit, and the white satin coverlet embroidered with gold thistles, quite an heirloom, which had been worked by the ladies of the house when James I slept there. Think of that, my dear! And so Mrs. Alwyn rambled on, recounting how Charles had shown her all the pictures himself, and the piazza where the orange and myrtle trees were, and how she and Mrs. Reynolds had gone for a drive together, in a beautiful landau, etc., till they reached home. As a rule, Ruth rather shrank from travelling with Mrs. Alwyn, who always journeyed in her best clothes, because you never know whom you may not meet. To stand on a platform with her was to be made conspicuous, and Ruth generally found herself unconsciously going into half-mourning for the day, when she went anywhere by rail with her aunt. Today Mrs. Alwyn was more gaily dressed than ever. But as Ruth looked at her beaming face, she felt nothing but a strange pleasure in the fact that Charles had not forgotten the little request which later events had completely effaced from her own memory. He, it seemed, had remembered, and in spite of what had passed, had done what she asked of him. She wished that she could have told him she was grateful. Alas, there were other things that she wished she could have told him, that she was sorry that she had misjudged him, that she understood him better now. But what did it matter? What did it matter? She was going to marry Dare, and he was the person whom she must try to understand for the remainder of her natural life. She thought a little wearily that she could understand him without trying. End of chapter 20. Chapter 21 of Sir Charles Danvers by Mary Chumley. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Simon Evers. Chapter 21. The 18th of October had arrived. Slumberly Hall was filling. The pheasants, reprieved till then, supposed it was only for partridge shooting, and thinking no evil, ate Indian corn, and took no thought for the annual St. Bartholomew of their race. Mabel Thursby had met Ruth out walking that day, and had informed her that Charles was to be one of the guns, also Dare, though, as she remembered to add, suspecting Dare admired Ruth, the latter was a bad shot, and was only asked out of neighbourly feeling. After parting with Mabel, Ruth met, almost at her own gate, Ralph Danvers, who passed her on horseback, and then turned on recognising her. Ralph's conversational powers were not great, and though he walked his horse beside her, he chiefly contented himself with assenting to Ruth's remarks until she asked after Molly. He at once whistled and flicked a fly off his horse's neck. "Sad business with Molly," he said. "The mother out for the day. Great grief in the nursery. Vic's dead."
"Oh, poor Molly."
"Died this morning. Fits.
I say," with a sudden inspiration, "you wouldn't go over and cheer her up, would you? Mother's out. I'm out. Magistrate's meeting."
Lou said she had nothing to do, would go over at once, and Ralph nodded kindly at her and rode on. He liked her, and it never occurred to him that it could be anything but a privilege to minister to any need of Molly's. He jogged on more happily after his meeting with Ruth, and only remembered half an hour later that he had completely forgotten to order the dog-cart to meet Charles, who was coming to Atherstone for a night before he went on to kill the Slumberly pheasants the following morning. Ruth set out at once over the pale stubble fields, glad of an object for a walk. Deep distress reigned meanwhile in the nursery at Atherstone. Vic, the much-beloved, the stout pursuer, the would-be churchgoer, Vic was dead, and Molly's soul refused comfort. In vain, nurse conveyed a palpitating guinea-pig into the nursery in a birdcage, on the narrow door of which remains of fur showed an unwilling entrance. Molly could derive no comfort from guinea-pigs. In vain was the new horse, with leather hoofs, with real hair, and a horsehair tail. In vain was that token of esteem from Uncle Charles brought out of its stable, and unevenly yoked with a dappled pony planted on a green, oval lawn, into Molly's own hay-cart. Molly's woe was beyond the reach of hay-carts or horsehair tails, however realistic. Like Hezekiah, she turned her face to the nursery wall, on which trains and railroads were depicted, and even when Cook herself rose up out of her kitchen to comfort her with material consolations, she refused the mockery of a gingerbread nut, which could not restore the friend with whom previous gingerbread nuts had always been equally divided. Presently a step came along the passage, and Charles, who had found no one in the drawing-room, came in tired and dusty, and inclined to be annoyed at having had to walk up from the station. Molly flew to him and flung her arms tightly round his neck.
"Oh, Uncle Charles, Uncle Charles, Vic is dead."
"I'm so sorry, Molly," taking her on his knee. Nurse and the nursery maid and cook withdrew, leaving the two mourners alone together.
"He's dead, Uncle Charles. He was quite well and eating Albert biscuits with the dolls this morning, and now—"
The rest was too dreadful, and Molly burst into a flood of tears and burrowed with her head against the faithful waistcoat of Uncle Charles. Uncle Charles, the friend, the consoler of all the ills that Molly had so far been heir to. "Vic had a very happy life, Molly," said Charles, pressing the little brown head against his cheek, and vaguely wondering what it would be like to have anyone to turn to in time of trouble.
"I always kept trouble from him, except that time I shut him in the door," gasped Molly. "I never took him out in a string, and he only wore his collar, that collar you gave him that made him scratch so, on Sundays."
"And he was not ill a long time. He did not suffer any pain?"
"No, Uncle Charles, not much. But though he did not say anything, his face looked worse than screaming, and he passed away very stiff in his hind legs. Oh,"
with a fresh outburst,
"when Cook told me that her sister that was in a decline had gone, I never thought," sob, sob, "poor Vic would be the next."
A step came along the passage, a firm, light step that Charles knew, that made his heart beat violently. The door opened, and a familiar voice said,
"Molly, my poor Molly, I met Father and—"
Ruth stood in the doorway and stopped short. A wave of colour passed over her face and left it paler than usual. Charles looked at her over the mop of Molly's brown head against his breast. Their grave eyes met, and each thought how ill the other looked.
"I did not know. I thought you were going to Slumberly today," said Ruth.
"I go tomorrow morning," replied Charles. "I came here first." There was an awkward silence, but Molly came to their relief by a sudden rush at Ruth and a repetition of the details of the deathbed scene of poor Vic for her benefit, for which both were grateful.
"You ought to be thinking where he is to be buried, Molly," suggested Charles when she had finished.
"Let us go into the garden and find a place." Molly revised somewhat at the prospect of a funeral, and though Ruth was anxious to leave her with her uncle, insisted on her remaining for the ceremony. They went out together, Molly holding a hand of each, to choose a suitable spot in the garden. By the time the grave had been dug by Charles, Molly was sufficiently recovered to take a lively interest in the proceedings, and to insist on the attendance of the stable cat in deep mourning, when the remains of poor Vic, arrayed in his best collar, were lowered into their long home. By the time the last duties to the dead had been performed, and Charles, under Molly's direction, had planted a rose tree on the grave, while Ruth surrounded the little mound with white pebbles, Molly's tea-time had arrived, and that young lady allowed herself to be led away by the nursery-maid, with the stable cat in a close embrace, resigned, and even cheerful, at the remembrance of those creature comforts of cook's, which earlier in the day she had refused so peremptorily. When Molly left them, Ruth and Charles walked together in silence to the garden gate which led to the footpath over the fields by which she had come. Neither had a word to say, who formerly had so much.
"Good-bye," she said without looking at him.
He seemed intent on the hasp of the gate. There was a moment's pause.
"I should like," said Ruth, hating herself for the formality of her tone, "to thank you before I go for giving Mrs. Albin so much pleasure. She still talks of her visit to you. It was kind of you to remember it. So much seems to have happened since then that I had not thought of it again."
At her last words, Charles raised his eyes and looked at her with strange, wistful intentness. But when Ruth had finished speaking, he had no remark to make in answer. And as he stood, bareheaded by the gate, twirling the hasp and looking, as a hasty glance told her, so worn and jaded in the sunshine, she said, "Good-bye," again, and turned hastily away. And all along the empty harvested fields, and all along the lanes where the hips and haws grew red and stiff among the ruddy hedgerows, Ruth still saw Charles's grave, worn face. That night she saw it still, as she sat in her own room, and listened to the whisper of the rain upon the roof, and the touch of its myriad fingers on the window panes.
"I cannot bear to see him look like that. I cannot bear it," she said suddenly.
And the storm which had been gathering so long, the clouds of which had darkened the sky for so many days, broke at last, with a strong and mighty wind of swift emotion which carried all before it. It was a relief to give way, to let the tempest do its worst, and remain passive. But when its force was spent at last, and it died away in gusts and flying showers, it left flood and wreckage and desolation behind. When Ruth raised her head and looked about her, all her landmarks were gone. There was a streaming glory in the heavens, but it shone on the ruin of all her little world below. She loved Charles, and she knew it. It seemed to her now as if, though she had not realized it, she must have loved him from the first. And with the knowledge came an overwhelming sense of utter misery that struck terror to her heart. She understood at last the meaning of the weariness and the restless misgivings of these last weeks. If heretofore they had spoken in riddles, they spoke plainly now. Every other feeling in the world seemed to have been swept away by a passion, the overwhelming strength of which she regarded panic-stricken. She seemed to have been asleep all her life, to have stirred restlessly once or twice of late, and now to have waked to consciousness and agony. Love, with women like Ruth, is a great happiness or a great calamity. It is with them, indeed, for better, for worse. Those whose feelings lie below the surface escape the hundred rubs and scratches which superficial natures are heir to. But it is the nerve which is not easily reached, which, when touched, gives forth the sharpest pang. Nature, when she gives intensity of feeling, mercifully covers it well with a certain superficial coldness. Ruth had sometimes wondered why the incidents, the books, which called forth emotion in others, passed her by. The vehement passion which once or twice in her life she had involuntarily awakened in others had met with no response from herself. The sight of the fire she had unwittingly kindled only made her shiver with cold. She believed herself to be cold, always a dangerous assumption on the part of a woman, and apt to prove a broken reed in emergency. Charles knew her better than she knew herself. Her pride and unconscious humble-mindedness, her frankness with its underlying reserve, spoke of a strong nature, slow perhaps, but earnest, constant, and once roused, capable of deep attachment. And now the common lot had befallen her, the common lot of man and womankind since Adam first met Eve in the Garden of Eden. Ruth was not exempt. She loved Charles. When the dawn came up, pale and tearful, to wake the birds, it found her still sitting by her window, sitting where she had sat all night, looking with blank eyes at nothing. "Creep into bed, Ruth, for although the sparrows are all waking, and their cheerful greetings to the new day add weariness to your weariness, creep into bed, for soon the servants will be stirring, and before long Martha, who has slept all night, and thinks your lines have fallen to you in pleasant places and late hours, will bring the hot water." End of chapter 21. Chapter 22 of Sir Charles Danvers by Mary Chumley. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Simon Evers. Chapter 22. Reserved people pay dear for their reserve when they are in trouble, when the iron enters into their soul, and their eyes meet the eyes of the world, tearless, unflinching, making no sign. Enviable are those whose sorrows are only pen and ink deep, who take every one into their confidence, who are comforted by sympathy, and fly to those who will weep with them. There is an utter solitude, a silence in the grief of a proud, reserved nature, which adds a frightful weight to its intensity. And when the night comes, and the chamber door is shut, who shall say what agonies of prayers and tears, what prostrations of despair, pass like waves over the soul to make the balance even? As a rule, the kindest and best of people seldom notice any alteration of appearance or manner in one of their own family. A stranger points it out, if ever it is pointed out, which happily is not often, unless, of course, in cases where advice has been disregarded, and the first symptom of ill health is jealously watched for and triumphantly hailed by those whose mission in life it is to say, "I told you so." Mrs. Alwyn, whose own complaints were of so slight a nature that they had to be constantly referred to give them any importance at all, was not likely to notice that Ruth's naturally pale complexion had become several degrees too pale during the last 2 days, or that she had dark rings under her eyes. Besides, only the day before, had not Mrs. Albin, in cutting out a child's shirt, cut out at the same time her best drawing-room tablecloth as well, which calamity had naturally driven out of her mind every other subject for the time. Ruth had proved unsympathetic, and Mrs. Alwyn had felt her to be so. The next day also, when Mrs. Alwyn had begun to talk over what she and Ralph were to wear that evening at a dinner party at Slumberly Hall, Ruth had again shown a decided want of interest, and was not even to be roused by the various conjectures of her aunt, though repeated over and over again, as to who would most probably take her in to dinner, who would be assigned to Mr. Alwyn, and whether Ruth would be taken in by a married man or a single one. As it was quite impossible absolutely to settle these interesting points beforehand, Mrs. Alwyn's mind had a vast field for conjecture open to her, in which she disported herself at will, varying the entertainment for herself and Ruth by speculating as to who would sit on the other side of each of them. "For, as she justly observed, everybody has two sides, my dear, and though, for my part, I can talk to anybody, members of Parliament, or bishops, or anyone, still it is difficult for a young person. And if you feel dull, Ruth, you can always turn to the person on the other side with some easy little remark." Ruth rose and went to the window. It had rained all yesterday. It had been raining all the morning today. But it was fair now. Nay, the sun was sending out long, burnished shafts from the broken grey and blue of the sky. She was possessed by an unreasoning longing to get out of the house into the open air, anywhere, no matter where, beyond the reach of Mrs. Alwyn's voice. She had been fairly patient with her for many months, but during these two last wet days a sense of sudden miserable irritation would seize her on the slightest provocation, which filled her with remorse and compunction, but into which she would relapse at a moment's notice. Every morning since her arrival, 9 months ago, had Mrs. Alwyn returned from her housekeeping with the same cheerful bustle, the same piece of information. "Well, Ruth, I've ordered dinner, my dear. First one duty, and then another." Why had that innocent and not unfamiliar phrase become so intolerable when she heard it again this morning? And when Mrs. Alwyn wound up the musical box, and the Buffalo Girls tinkled on the ear to relieve the monotony of a wet morning, why should Ruth have struggled wildly for a moment with a sudden inclination to laugh and cry at the same time, which resulted in two large tears falling unexpectedly, to her surprise and shame, upon her book? She shut the book, and recovering herself with an effort, listened patiently to Mrs. Alwyn's remarks, until, early in the afternoon, the sky cleared. Making some excuse about going to see her old nurse at the lodge at Arley, who was still ill, she at last effected her escape out of the room and out of the house. The air was fresh and clear, though cold. The familiar fields and beaded hedgerows, the red land, new ploughed, where the plovers hovered, the grey broken sky above, soothed Ruth like the presence of a friend, as nature, even in her commonest moods, has ministered to many a one who has loved her before Ruth's time. Our human loves partake always of the nature of speculations. We have no security for our capital, which fortunately is seldom so large as we suppose, but the love of nature is a sure investment, which she repays a thousandfold, which she repays most prodigally when the heart is bankrupt and full of bitterness, as Ruth's heart was that day. For in nature, as Wordsworth says, there is no bitterness, that worst sting of human grief. And as Ruth walked among the quiet fields and up the yellow aisles of the autumn glades to Arley, nature spoke of peace to her, not of joy or of happiness as in old days, for she never lies as human comforters do, and these have gone out of her life, but of the peace that duty steadfastly adhered to will bring at last, the peace that after much turmoil will come in the end to those who, amid a babel of louder tongues, hear and obey the low-pitched voices of conscience and of principle. For it never occurred to Ruth for a moment to throw over Dare and marry Charles. She had given her word to Dare, and her word was her bond. It was as much a matter of being true to herself as to him. It was very simple. There were no two ways about it in her mind. The idea of breaking off her engagement was not to be thought of. It would be dishonourable. We often think that if we had been placed in the same difficulties which we see overwhelm others, we would have got out of them. Just so. We might have squeezed, or wriggled, or crept out of a position from which another who would not stoop could not have escaped. People are differently constituted. Most persons with common sense can sink their principles temporarily, at a pinch, but others there are who go through life prisoners on parole to their sense of honour or duty. If escape takes the form of a temptation, they do not escape. And Ruth, walking with bent head beneath the swaying trees, dreamed of no escape. She soon reached the little lodge, the rusty gates of which barred the grass-grown drive to the shattered, tenantless old house at a little distance. It was a small grey stone house of many gables and low lines of windows that, if inhabited, would possess but little charm, but which, in its deserted state, had a certain pathetic interest. The place had been to let for many years, but no one had taken it. No one was likely to take it in the disrepair which was now fast sliding into ruin. The garden beds were almost grown over with weeds, but blots of nasturtium colour showed here and there among the ragged green, and a Virginia creeper had done its gorgeous red and yellow best to cheer the grey stone walls. But the place had a dreary appearance, even in the present sunshine, and after looking at it for a moment, Ruth went indoors to see her old nurse. After sitting with her and reading the usual favourite chapter in the big Bible, and answering the usual question of, "Any news of Master Raymond?" in the usual way, Ruth got up to go, and the old woman asked her if she wanted the drawing-block which she had left with her some time ago, with an unfinished sketch on it of the stables. She got it out, and Ruth looked at it. It was a slight sketch of an octagonal building with wide arches all round it, roofing in a paved path on which, in days gone by, It had evidently been the pernicious custom to exercise the horses, whose stalls and loose boxes formed the centre of the building. The stable had a certain quaintness, and the sketch was at that delightful point when no random stroke has as yet falsified the promise that a finished drawing, however clever, so seldom fulfils. Ruth took it up and looked out of the window. The sun was blazing out, ashamed of his absence for so long. She might as well finish it now. She was glad to be out of the way of meeting anyone, especially the shooters, whose guns she had heard in the nearer slumberly coverts several times that afternoon. The Arleywoods she knew were to be kept till later in the month. She took her block and paint-box, and picking her way along the choked gravel walk and down the side drive to the stables, sat down on the bench for chopping wood which had been left in the place to which she had previously dragged it, and set to work. She was sitting under one of the arches out of the wind, and an obsequious yellow cat came out of the door of one of the nearest horse-boxes, in which wood was evidently stacked, and rubbed itself against her dress with a reckless expenditure of hair. As Ruth stopped a moment, bored but courteous, to return its well-meant attentions by friction behind the ears, she heard a slight crackling among the wood in the stable. Rats abounded in the place, and she was just about to recall the cat to its professional duties, when her own attention was also distracted. She started violently and grasped the drawing-block in both hands. Clear over the gravel, muffled but still distinct across the long wet grass, she could hear a firm step coming. Then it rang out sharply on the stone pavement. A tall man came suddenly round the corner, under the archway, and stood before her. It was Charles. The yellow cat, which had a leaning towards the aristocracy, left Ruth, and picking its way daintily over the round stones towards him, rubbed off some more of its wardrobe against his heather shooting stockings. "I hardly think it is worthwhile to say anything except the truth," said Charles at last. "I have followed you here." As Ruth could say nothing in reply, it was fortunate that at the moment she had nothing to say. She continued to mix a little pool of Prussian blue and Italian pink without looking up. "I hurt my gun hand after luncheon and had to stop shooting at Croxton Corner. As I went back to Slumberley, across the fields below the rectory, I thought I saw you in the distance and followed you." "Is your hand much hurt?" with sudden anxiety. "No," said Charles, reddening a little. "It will stop my shooting for a day or two, but that is all." The colours were mixed again. Ruth, contrary to all previous conviction, added light red to the Italian pink. The sketch had gone rapidly from bad to worse, but the light red finished it off. It never, so to speak, held up its head again, but I believe she has it still somewhere, put away in a locked drawer in tissue paper, as if it were very valuable. "I did not come without a reason," said Charles, after a long pause, speaking with difficulty. "It's no good beating about the bush. I want to speak to you again about what I told you 3 weeks ago. Have you forgotten what that was?" Ruth shook her head. She had not forgotten. Her hand began to tremble, and he sat down beside her on the bench, and taking the brush out of her hand, laid it in its box. "Ruth," he said gently, "I have not been very happy during the last 3 weeks, but 2 days ago, when I saw you again, I thought you did not look as if you had been very happy either. Am I right? Are you happy in your engagement with... quite content? Quite satisfied?" Still silent, am I to have no answer? "Some questions have no answers," said Ruth, steadily, looking away from him. "At least the questions that ought not to be asked have none." "I will not ask any more, then. Perhaps, as you say, I have no right. You won't tell me whether you are unhappy, but your face tells me so, in spite of you. It told me so 2 days ago, and I have thought of it every hour of the day and night since." She gathered herself together for her final effort to stop what she knew was coming, and said, desperately, "I don't know how it is, I don't mean it, and yet everything I say to you seems so harsh and unkind. But I think it would have been better not to come here, and I think it would be better for us both if you would go away now." Charles's face became set and very white. Then he put his fortune to the touch. "You're right," he said. "I will go away, for good. I will never trouble you again when you have told me that you do not love me." The colour rushed into her face, and then died slowly away again, even out of the tightly compressed lips. There was a long silence, in which he waited for a reply that did not come. At last she turned and looked him in the face. Who has said that light eyes cannot be impassioned? Her deep eyes, dark with the utter blankness of despair, fell before the intensity of his. He leaned towards her, and with gentle strength put his arm round her and drew her to him. His voice came in a broken whisper of passionate entreaty close to her ear. "Ruth, I love you, and you love me. We belong to each other. We were made for each other. Life is not possible apart. It must be together. Ruth, always together. Always." And his voice broke down entirely. Surely he was right. A love such as theirs overrode all petty barriers of everyday right and wrong, and was a law unto itself. Surely it was vain to struggle against fate, against the soft yet mighty current which was sweeping her away beyond all landmarks, beyond the sight of land itself, out towards an infinite sea. And the eyes she loved looked into hers with an agony of entreaty, and the voice she loved spoke of love, spoke brokenly of unworthiness and an unhappy past, and of a brighter future, a future with her. Her brain reeled, her reason had gone. Let her yield now. Surely, if only she could think, if the power to think had not deserted her, it was right to yield. The current was taking her ever swifter, whither she knew not. A moment more, and there would be no going back. She began to tremble, and wrenching her hands out of his, pressed them before her eyes to shut out the sight of the earnest face so near her own. But she could not shut out his voice, and Charles's voice could be very gentle, very urgent. But at the 11th hour, another voice broke in on his, and spoke as one having authority. Conscience, if accustomed to be disregarded on common occasions, will rarely come to the fore with any decision in emergency. But the weakest do not put him in a place of command all their lives without at least one result, that he has learned the habit of speaking up and making himself attended to in time of need. He spoke now, urgently, imperatively. Her judgment, her reason, were alike gone for the time, but when she had paced the solemn aisles of the woods an hour ago in possession of them, had she then even thought of doing what she was on the verge of doing now? What had happened during that hour to reverse the steadfast resolve which she had made then? What she had thought right an hour ago remained right now. What she had put far from her as dishonourable then remained dishonourable now, though she might be too insane to see it. Terror seized her, as of one in a dream who is conscious of impending danger and struggles to awake before it is too late. She started to her feet, and putting forcibly aside the hands that would have held her back, walked unsteadily towards the nearest pillar, and leaned against it, trembling violently. "Do not tempt me," she said hoarsely. "I cannot bear it." He came and stood beside her. "I do not tempt you," he said. "I want to save you and myself from a great calamity before it is too late."
"It is too late already."
"No," said Charles, in a low voice of intense determination. "It is not. Yet, it will be soon. It is still possible to go back. You are not married to him, and it is no longer right that you should marry him. You must give him up. There is no other way." "Yes," said Ruth, with vehemence, "there is another way. You have made me forget it, but before you came I saw it clearly. I can't think it out as I did then, but I know it is there. There is another way," and her voice faltered, "to do what is right, and let everything else go." Charles saw for the first time, with a sudden frightful contraction of the heart, that her will was as strong as his own. He had staked everything on one desperate appeal to her feelings. He carried the outworks, and now another adversary, her conscience, rose up between him and her. "A marriage without love is a sin," he said quietly. "If you had lived in the world as long as I have, and had seen what marriage without love means, and what it generally comes to in the end, you would know that I am speaking the truth. You have no right to marry Dare if you care for me. Hesitate, and it will be too late. Break off your engagement now. Do you suppose," with sudden fire,
that we shall cease to love each other, that I shall be able to cease to love you for the rest of my life because you are Dare's wife? What is done can't be undone. Our love for each other can't. It's no good shutting your eyes to that. Look the facts in the face, and don't deceive yourself into thinking that the most difficult course is necessarily the right one.
He turned from her and sat down on the bench again, his chin in his hands, his haggard eyes fastened on her face. He had said his last word, and she felt that when she spoke it would be her last word too. Neither could bear much more.
"All you say sounds right, at first," she said, after a long silence,
and as she spoke Charles's hands dropped from his face and clinched themselves together.
"But I cannot go by what anyone thinks, unless I think so myself as well. I can't take other people's judgments. When God gave us our own, he did not mean us to shirk using it. What you say is right, but there's something which, after a little bit, seems more right, at least, which seems so to me. I cannot look at the future. I can only see one thing distinctly, now, in the present, and that is that I cannot break my word. I never have been able to see that a woman's word is less binding than a man's. When I said I would marry him, it was of my own free will. I knew what I was doing, and it was not only for his sake I did it. It is not as if he believed I cared for him very much. Then, perhaps, but he knows I don't, and he's different from other men. He does not seem to mind. I knew at the time that I accepted him for the sake of other things, which are just the same now as they were then, because he was poor and I had money, because I felt sure he would never do much by himself, and I thought I could help him, and my money would help too. Because the people at Vanden are so wretched, and their cottages are tumbling down, and there is no one who lives among them and cares about them. I can't make it clear, and I did hesitate, but at the time it seemed wrong to hesitate. If it seemed so right then, it cannot be all wrong now. Even if it has become hard, I cannot give it all up. He is building cottages that I am to pay for, that I asked to pay for. He cannot. And he has promised so many people their houses shall be put in order, and they all believe him. And he can't do it. If I don't, it will not be done. And some of them are very old, and the winter is coming.
Ruth's voice had become almost inaudible.
"Oh, Charles, Charles," she said brokenly, "I cannot bear to hurt you. God knows I love you. I think I shall always love you. I shall try not. But I cannot go back now from what I have undertaken. I cannot break my word. I cannot do what is wrong, even for you. Oh, God, not even for you."
She knelt down beside him and took his clenched hands between her own, but he did not stir.
"Not even for you,"
she whispered, while two hot tears fell upon his hands. In another moment she had risen swiftly to her feet and had left him. End of chapter 22. Chapter 23 of Sir Charles Danvers by Mary Chumley. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Simon Evers. Chapter 23. Charles sat quite still where Ruth had left him, looking straight in front of him. He had not thought for a moment of following her, of speaking to her again. Her decision was final, and he knew it. And now he also knew how much he had built upon the wild new hope of the last 2 days. Presently, a slight discreet cough broke upon his ear, apparently close at hand. He started up, and wheeling round in the direction of the sound, called out in sudden anger, "Who is there?" If there is a time when we feel that a fellow creature is entirely out of harmony with ourselves, it is when we discover that he has overheard or overseen us at a moment when we imagined we were alone, or almost alone. Charles was furious. "Come out," he said, in a tone that would have made any ordinary creature stay as far in as it could. And hearing a slight crackling in the nearest horse-box, of which the door stood open, he shook the door violently. "Come out," he repeated, "this instant." "Stop that noise, then," said a voice sharply from the inside, "and keep quiet. By God, a violent temper, what a thing it is!
always raising a dust and kicking up a row just when it's least wanted.
The voice made Charles start.
Great God, he said, it's not...
Yes, it is, was the reply, and when you've taken a seat on the farther end of that bench and recovered your temper, I'll show, and not before.
Charles walked to the bench and sat down.
You can come out, he said in a carefully lowered voice, in which there was contempt as well as anger. Accordingly, there was a little more crackling among the faggots, and a slight, shabbily dressed man came to the door and peered wearily out, shading his blinking eyes with his hand.
"If there is a thing I hate," he said, with a curious mixture of recklessness and anxiety, "it is a noise. Sid said that you face the left, will you, and I'll look after the right, and if you see anyone coming you may as well mention it. I'm only at home to old friends."
He took his hand from his eyes as they became more accustomed to the light, and showed a shrewd, dissipated face that yet had a kind of ruined good looks about it, and what was more hateful for Charles than anything else, a decided resemblance to Ruth. Though he was shabby in the extreme, his clothes sat upon him as they always and only do sit upon a gentleman, and though his face and voice showed that he had severed himself effectually from the class in which he had been born, a certain unsuitability remained between his appearance and his evidently disreputable circumstances. When Charles looked at him, he was somehow reminded of a broken-down thoroughbred in a hansom cab.
"It is a quiet spot," remarked Raymond Dancourt, for he it was, standing in the doorway, his watchful eyes scanning the deserted courtyard and strip of green.
"A retired and peaceful spot. I'm sorry if my cough annoyed you, coming when it did, but I thought you seemed before to be engaged in conversation, which I felt a certain diffidence in interrupting."
"So you listened, I suppose?"
"Yes, I listened. I did not hear as much as I could have wished, but it was your best manner, Danvers.
You certainly have a gift, though you dropped your voice unnecessarily once or twice, I thought. If I had had your talents, I should not be here now."
"Dear me, you can swear still, can you? How refreshing! I fancied you were quite reformed."
"Why are you here now?" asked Charles sternly.
Raymond shrugged his shoulders.
"Why are you here?" continued Charles bitterly, "when you swore to me in July that if I would pay your passage out again to America, you would let her alone in the future? Why are you here when I wrote to tell you that she promised me she would never give you money again without advice?
But I might have known you could break a promise as easily as make one. I might have known you would only keep it as long as it suited yourself."
"Well, now, I'm glad to hear you say that," said Raymond airily, "because it takes off any feeling of surprise I was afraid you might feel at seeing me back here. There's nothing like a good understanding between friends. I'm precious hard up, I can tell you, or I should not have come. And when a fellow has got into as tight a place as I have, he's got to think of other things besides keeping promises. Have you seen today's papers?"
With sudden eagerness.
"Yes."
"Any news about the Frisco forgery case?"
And Raymond leaned forward through the door and spoke in a whisper.
"Nothing much," said Charles, trying to recollect. "Nothing new today, I think. You know they got one of them 2 days ago, followed him down to Birmingham and took him in the train?"
Raymond drew in his breath.
"I don't hold with trains," he said after a pause, "at least not with passengers. I told him as much at the time. And the other one, Stevens, any news of him?"
"Nothing more about him as far as I can remember. They were both traced together from Broxton to London, but there they parted company. Stevens is at large still."
"Is he?" said Raymond. "By George, I'm glad to hear it. I hope he'll keep so, that's all. I'm glad I left that fool. He's not my notions at all. We split 2 days ago, and I made tracks for the old diggings. Got down as far as Tarbury under a tarpaulin in a goods train. There's some sense in a goods train. And then lay close by a weir of the canal, and got aboard a barge after dark. Nothing breaks a scent like a barge. And it went the right way for my business, too, and travelled all night. I kept close all next day, and then struck across country for this place at night. If I hadn't known the lie of the land from a boy when I used to spend the holidays with old Alwyn, I couldn't have done it, or I'd have been as dog-lame as I was in July. But I was pushed for time, and I footed it up here and got in just before dawn. And not too soon either, for I'm cleaned out, and food is precious hard to come by if you don't care to go shopping for it. I'm only waiting till it's dark to go and get something from the old woman at the lodge. She looked after me before, but it wasn't so serious then as it is now."
"It will be penal servitude for life this time for Stevens," said Charles.
"Yes,"
said Raymond thoughtfully. "It's playing deuced high. I knew that at the time, but I thought it was worth it. It was a beautiful thing, and there was a mint of money in it if it had gone straight. A mint of money." And he shook his head regretfully. "But the luck is bound to change in the end," he went on, after a moment of mournful retrospection. "You'll see, I shall make my pile yet, Danvers. One can't go on turning up tails all the time." "You will turn them up once too often," said Charles, "and get your affairs wound up for you some day in a way you won't like. But I suppose it's no earthly use my saying anything." "Not much," replied the other. "I guess I've heard it all before. Don't you remember how you held forth that night in the wood? You came out too strong. I felt as if I were in church. But you forked out handsomely at the collection afterwards. I will say that for you." "And what are you going to do now you've got here?" interrupted Charles sharply. "Lie by." "How long?" "Perhaps a week, perhaps 10 days. Can't say." "And after that?" "After that, someone, I don't know who, but someone will have to provide me with the ready to nip across to France. I have friends in Paris where I can manage to scratch along for a bit till things have blown over." Charles considered for a few moments and then said, "Are you going to dun your sister for money again, or give her another fright by lying in wait for her? Of course, if you break your word about coming back, you might break it about trying to get money out of her." "I might," assented Raymond. "In fact, I was on the point of making my presence known to her, and suggesting a pecuniary advance, when you came up. I don't know present what I shall do, as I let that opportunity slip. It just depends." Charles considered again. "It's a pity to trouble her, isn't it?" said Raymond, his shrewd eyes watching him. "And women are best out of money matters. Besides, if she's promised you she won't pay up without advice, she'll stick to it. Nothing will turn her when she once settles on anything, if she's at all like what she used to be. She's got dollars of her own. You'd better settle with me and pay yourself back when you're married. Dear me, there's no occasion to look so murderous. I suppose I'm at liberty to draw my own conclusions." "You'd better draw them a little more carefully in future," said Charles savagely. "Your sister is engaged to a married to a man without a sixpence." "By George," said Raymond, "that won't suit my book at all. I'd rather," with another glance at Charles, "I'd rather she'd married a man with money." If Charles was of the same opinion, he did not express it. He remained silent for a few minutes to give weight to his last remark, and then said slowly, "So you see, you won't get anything more from that quarter. You better make the most you can out of me." Raymond nodded. "The most you will get, in fact I may say all you will get from me, is enough ready money to carry you to Paris, and a cheque for £20 to follow when I hear you have arrived there."
"It's mean," said Raymond. "It's cursed mean. And from a man like you, too, whom I feel for as a brother. I'd rather try my luck with Ruth. She's not married yet, anyway."
"You will do as you like," said Charles, getting up. "If I find you've been trying your luck with her, as you call it, you won't get a farthing from me afterwards. And, you may remember, she can't help you without consulting her friends. And your complaint is one that requires absolute quiet, or I'm very much mistaken."
Raymond bit his finger and looked irresolute.
"Today is Wednesday," said Charles. "On Saturday I shall come back here in the afternoon, and if you have come to my terms by that time, you can cough after I do. I shall have the money on me. If you make any attempt to write or speak to your sister, I shall take care to hear of it, and you need not expect me on Saturday. That is the last remark I have to make, so good afternoon."
And without waiting for a reply, Charles walked away, conscious that Raymond would not dare either to call or run after him. He walked slowly along the grass-grown road that led into the carriage drive, and was about to let himself out of the grounds by a crazy gate, which rather took away from the usefulness of the large iron-locked one at the lodge, when he perceived an old man with a pail of water fumbling at it. He did not turn as Charles drew near, and even when the latter came up with him and said, "Good afternoon," he made no sign. Charles watched him groping for the hasp, and when he got the gate open, feel about for the pail of water, which when he found it struck against the goat-post as he carried it through. Charles looked after the old man as he shambled off in the direction of the lodge. "Blind and deaf, he'll tell no tales at any rate," he said to himself. "Raymond is in luck there." It had turned very cold, and suddenly remembering that his absence might be noticed, he set off through the woods to Slumberley at a good pace.
His nearest way took him through the churchyard and across the adjoining high road, on the farther side of which stood the little red-faced lodge, which belonged to the great new red-faced seat of the Thursbys at a short distance. He came rapidly round the corner of the old church tower, and was already swinging down the worn sandstone steps which led into the road, when he saw below him at the foot of the steps a little group of people standing talking. It was Mr. Alwyn and Ruth and Dare, who had evidently met them on his return from shooting, and who, standing at ease with one elegantly gaitered leg on the lowest step, and a cartridge bag slung over his shoulders in a way that had aroused Charles's indignation earlier in the day, was recounting to them, with vivid action of the hands on an imaginary gun, his own performances to right and left at some particularly hot corner. Mr. Alwyn was listening with a benignant smile. Charles saw that Ruth was leaning heavily against the low stone wall. Before he had time to turn back, Mr. Alwyn had seen him, and had gone forward a step to meet him, holding out a welcoming hand. Charles was obliged to stop a moment while his hand was inquired after, and a new treatment, which Mr. Alwyn had found useful on a similar occasion, was enjoined upon him. As they stood together on the church steps, a fly, heavily laden with luggage, came slowly up the road towards them. "What?" said Mr. Alwyn. "More visitors? I thought all the Slumberly party arrived yesterday." The fly plodded past the Slumberly lodge, however, and as it reached the steps, a shrill voice suddenly called to the driver to stop. As it came grinding to a standstill, the glass was hastily pulled down, and a little woman with a very bold pair of black eyes and a somewhat laced-in figure got out and came towards them. "Well, Mr. Dare," she said in a high, distinct voice with a strong American accent, "I guess you did not expect to see me riding up this way, or you'd have sent the carriage to bring your wife up from the station. But I'm not one to bear malice, so if you want a lift home to, what's the name of your fine new place, you can get in and ride up along with me." Dare looked straight in front of him. No one spoke. Her quick eye glanced from one to another of the little group, and she gave a short, constrained laugh. "Well," she said, "if you ain't coming, you can stop with your friends. I've had a deal of travelling one way and another, and I'll go on without you." And turning quickly away, she told the driver in the same distinct high key to go on to Vanden, and got into the fly again. The grinning man chucked at the horse's bridle, and the fly rattled heavily away. No one spoke as it drove away. Charles glanced once at Ruth, but her set white face told him nothing. As the fly disappeared up the road, Dare moved a step forward. His face under his brown skin was an ashen grey. He took off his cap, and extending it at arm's length, not towards the sky, but like a good churchman towards the church, outside of which, as he knew, his Maker was not to be found, he said solemnly, "I swear before God what she says is one great lie." End of chapter 23.
Hey, hockey fans! Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at USAHockeyNTDP.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.